Okay, I'd like to welcome you all. I'm proud of all of us for making it here at 8:30 in the morning. This is session 116. The title is Selective Moral Principles, Mormons and Torture. And it's going to be presented by Nancy Cater. Did I pronounce your last name correctly? Mm-hmm. Okay. I ask you, before we start, if you could just turn off cell phones or any other noise-making devices out of courtesy. To briefly introduce Nancy, she's received a B.S. in nursing from BYU and a Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of Maryland, College Park. While living in Utah, she was chair of the Utah County Democratic Party. She's originally from Ogden, but now resides in Virginia, and she is a consulting bioethicist in Virginia. And her husband is Omar. He's sitting in the back, and he will actually be presenting tonight at 8 p.m. So we'll keep that on your radar. So without further ado, Nancy.
Thank you very much. So do I have to stand anywhere in particular to make the sound work?
I think you're fine. This is an recording device, so you should be fine. Okay.
Well, many of you might know that this session was originally intended to present some ideas about how religions have historically involved themselves with such political pressures as interrogation, inquisition, even torture. These ideas are still on the table, but since our original presenter, he's here visiting, I guess, but I'm replacing him, and so I'm going to broaden the scope a little bit over what it was originally. My PhD is in philosophy with an emphasis on ethics, and so I actually did quite a little research on torture, and I presented some interesting stuff, I think, on torture at the DC symposium about, 3 years ago or something. I've kind of cross-fertilized with my husband's work that he's going to talk about later tonight. Omar and I are just home visiting for this occasion. We usually have family reunions around the 24th, so that's the only reason we're here. But he's going to do something tonight at 8, so I'll brag up him, and we may say some similar things because we've been talking about this quite a bit. Anyway, we're both trying to respond to the theme this year about the intersection of Mormonism and politics. She introduced me, I was very involved in politics when I lived in Utah and was the Utah County Democratic Chairman. And in those days, we actually won an election or two. You might recall this was back in the Matheson era and Gunn McKay era and so on. And even then, if we got 25 or 30% of the vote out of Utah County, we could win the state, you know. Now you can't even get that good of Democratic vote out of there. I have followed politics in the church very closely all these years. And I would say for at least the last 25 or so that I'm aware of, the church has somewhat bitterly asserted its exclusion from and its right to be heard in the public square. I'm sure you've all heard that. In Ensign articles and speeches, one can easily find a repeated complaint that religious voices are being squelched and are being denied access, while secular voices gain ascendancy and respect. The church wants its beliefs and preachings to be competitive with the more worldly viewpoints, and they assert the right to engage in politics when issues they deem moral are at stake. But my question is, how does the church, and not just ours but any church, determine which moral values are so important that they should get out and fight for them and take formal stands and support with their political money? And what is the appropriate way to fight for your beliefs without facing a charge of either hypocrisy or coercion? Because churches can be held suspect either way. One only has to consider the Catholic Church currently trying to deal with their ongoing sexual abuse scandals. On some cases, they have been so protective of the priests and leaders in their church that participated in the abuse that they look like hypocrites and at the same time fighting it. Well, before I get into examples in our own religion of these kind of clashes between moral choices and politics, I want to define a little more carefully what is meant by the public square. The public square is the sort of free discussion of ideas among the larger community. It involves our ability to publicly speak, write, and politically support our beliefs. It is, in a general way, the method by which we try to persuade one another, at least in free countries. However, to enter the debate on any subject in the public square, we must use a common language, and religion is not a common language. Our church feels excluded from the public square. Our church feels that it's not being respected or heard. But the problem is, how can we speak to one another if we speak in different languages? Well, not only non-religious people, but those of other religions, of course, have grown in our country. Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, Sikhs, all have different ways of making their voices heard in the public square, and often have difficulty understanding one another when the discourse is religious. And as we all know, Mormons have their own problems, especially with the evangelicals. So even though we work together on some things, we clash very much on others. So the problem, in my opinion anyway, is that using religious language commits yourself to persuading others only through scriptural beliefs, assertions of prophecy, assertions of priesthood authority, and these aren't persuasive ways of dealing with people who have different beliefs. This is a reason that we speak of separation of church and state in America, so that we can try to avoid the unintended consequences when one religion might take precedence over another or over non-religious people. Last night, the speaker referred to those as the nuns. I don't know if that will become common for us here this week, but the nuns are those who have no religious background. The consequences of being in the public square can be discrimination against those who differ in many ways. In other words, the reason that we have been so guarded in America about how we speak to one another is to avoid discrimination against anyone, especially minority groups. We all know this. So ethnicity, gender, age, so on. We're trying to protect them. So when the church wants more inclusion in the public square, that's fine, but they have to be able to speak to everyone. They can't just speak to themselves and try to assert authority. Now, Dallin Oaks and others, and I have a whole bunch of Ensign talks and so on, conference talks, they have commented in these speeches over and over that many great accomplishments in America would not have taken place without religious pressure. They include the abolition of slavery and 60 civil rights as examples of how religion has had a very positive impact in the public square. But we also cannot forget the churches did not all fight for these rights. They were against interracial marriages. They were against interracial activities. Of course, we know that religions were on both sides of the Civil War. Many have prioritized their biblical interpretation over others. And I'll just throw in, for instance, Israeli Jews use scripture to assert their privilege of dominating over the Palestinian Muslims in the territories. So the separation of church and state embodies several important goods that we value in America, and I'll just mention them really quickly. First of all, it enables freedom and liberty. I know you all know this, but I'll say it again. Our expressions and our beliefs are more valued because there's no state religion and no state domination. The separation of church and state values equality of all people so that nobody is privileged. All of us as humans are equal and respected. And number three, all of us can be heard in the public square, but through the conflicting and balancing of many, many opinions. So nobody has any special privileges there. But what is the language? If you want to be heard, if you want to make your case, if you want to persuade anyone else to agree with you, well, it can only be that of reason, because this is our common language in America. We use science, we use logic, we use reason, and we use common sense. And if we can agree on those kind of terms, then persuasive argument is valued. We can use debate. We can have thoughtful discussion. Of course, we can't forget that we can also use super PACs and we can use political ads, but that's a different story. So now with all that being said, I'm going to go briefly into a little bit about how torture and the Mormon belief in the saving of the Constitution and our destiny to save the Constitution kind of came together to cause torture. Let's see. So I need to go to this page. Sorry. You know, I'll just very briefly talk about how long before 9/11 and the War on Terror, there was an assault on the Constitution by Cheney. And a lot of people don't know about this, but there's quite a few books written about it. And it's known as the Unitary Executive Theory. That means that the... let me see if I can jump a little bit here. It is basically the idea that the executive branch has not had enough power in this country, and they need to fight back against the courts and the and Congress in making their decisions. So I'll talk a little bit more about this, but ironically, the support structure that made that change in interpretation of the Constitution was created primarily by Mormons. And people don't really know that, especially I think it's ironic since we believe the Constitution might hang by a thread and be saved by the elders. The two that I have specifically in mind are named Timothy Flanagan and Jay Bybee. And I'll just say right now that everything I say about them I've taken from written documentation, so I'm not just standing here putting down these people, and actually I know them. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Our folk culture in the church has long considered that the Constitution will someday hang by a thread. You've all heard that. It's considered to be a folk prophecy because even though it's often cited, the roots of this prophecy are somewhat obscure. It's not now, at least, formally accepted by the church leader, by the church leadership. But interestingly, I have a talk by Ezra Taft Benson, still quoted in the 80s, in which he gives us the citation, which was that it was overheard by a woman in 1840 in a talk by Joseph Smith, and she, I guess, wrote it in her diary, and that's how the story was passed down. I think the white horse, some of you know more than me, apparently the elders would come in on a white horse. I don't know exactly what was thought of. But anyway, if the Constitution was going to be saved, it would be by elders. Well, one of the sad parts about that is that in this case that I'm talking about today, we're going to have to bring some other elders to save it because the ones that were here have endangered it. So one of the most important features of the Constitution is the separation of powers. I've already said that. And so how did it come about that these two faithful and active priesthood holders in the church, although very far right-wing in their politics, are now despised for endangering the Constitution and threatening the separation of powers doctrine? They had high positions in the Bush administration. They wrote secret memos, and they were very, very endangering of the values we hold dear in America. And their legal writings led to explicit harms, not just abstract harms. The war, the wiretapping of American citizens without warrant, eavesdropping, long-term imprisonment without trial, unprecedented secrecy, and torture. These fellows have now faced possible war crimes prosecutions and criminal prosecutions. They still face the inability to travel outside our borders due to a fear of being prosecuted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes. I'll just say, I guess at this point, that Tim Flanagan was a member of our ward in Reston, Virginia during the time of this actions. We were all aware in the ward of the highly responsible nature of his job, but we didn't have any idea of the particulars that he was doing. He was well thought of and admired as a responsible and active member of the church and family man. The ward I'm in now in Vienna, Virginia, was formerly attended by Jay Bybee. His parents are in nearby ward. He's also very favorably remembered, well-liked, active, popular gospel doctrine teacher. And yet, I do remember Flanagan one time sort of making it clear in church that he was, as he reported for Ashcroft, who was the Attorney General at the time, that he was so happy that he was working for a religious leader, whereas the Democrats didn't, he feel, had, of course, religious people in charge of the country. But this was a man whom he respected because every morning they got together and they got on their knees and prayed together before they went about their business.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, were they both part of the Justice Department?
Yes.
Flanagan, too?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me skip. So just one quick background on the unitary executive power. That idea came out of Nixon and Watergate because so many of the conservatives were frustrated at what happened to Nixon. As you recall, Cheney worked for Cheney and Rumsfeld both had high positions actually in the Ford administration after Nixon got booted out. And they felt very circumscribed by the post-Vietnam era reforms, especially War Powers Act, which prohibited the president from conducting wars without the permission of Congress. Cheney, in particular, was very angry about this check on their powers. When he became a congressman, Cheney was a congressman starting in 79, he set out to find ways to get around the rules. There's a book written by Jack Goldsmith, who worked in the Office of Legal Counsel, and said that long before 9/11, his bosses had set out to reverse this decades-long illegitimate intrusions on executive power. So this idea gained traction during the Reagan administration, and then by the time that we had Bush in power, it had really taken hold. Addington is another person who's not a Mormon, but I may mention his name sometimes here, because he was one of the leaders who did this sort of thing. But and I do have a quote where one person recalls sitting in meetings with Addington and Cheney and wondering, how did these lunatics end up running the country? Their manners were insistent and loud, and they don't believe there should be co-equal branches of government. Now, this same idea had been experimented with during the Iran-Contra scandal back in the Reagan administration. A secret ad hoc group then, if you recall, conducted some foreign policy without congressional oversight. Remember the cake and the... the Contras. Anyway, Goldsmith said the president does feel on occasion duty-bound to assert monarchical notions of prerogative that will permit him to exceed the laws. Well, one other little group I'll name is the Federalist Society. Federalist Society is a group that was created in 1982 as a way to counteract the liberal influence of the American Bar Association. So this is a group of lawyers who were right-wing who felt that the bar was too liberal. And they have become quite powerful because they have sought to be the group that interviews and encourages certain names to be brought up for, you know, government positions. The founders were like Robert Bork and Ed Meese. Orrin Hatch is a big leader in it. Their goal is to fundamentally, quote, reshape the landscape of the U.S. judiciary by promoting right-wing activists. Well, Flanagan is a leader here, and anybody who hears any talks at BYU by some of these lawyers will find out that the Federalist Society is the backer. It was difficult for any lawyers to be nominated to a White House position under Bush without the backing of the society. And then, let's see, I'll just say that the idea of the unitary executive is not supported by mainstream legal scholars or historians. Most of those who study the Constitution believe that the intent of the founders was to ensure against that very thing so that not one branch wouldn't have any power over the others, and they would all check each other. That's why we learn about separation of powers in school. And it was controversial even among conservative Republicans. There's a great book by Barton Gellman on Cheney, and he says secrecy was one of the outgrowths of the situation because they knew that it wasn't accepted by everybody. But they felt that the public and other branches of government did not have a right to look behind the curtain of the White House. And so what does that bring us to? So they've already got this mindset. They're already heading this direction, and then 9/11 happened. And immediately, as you know, there was the War Council was assembled in the White House bunker. The War Council included Tim Flanagan. This is how important he was. There was John Yoo, the lawyer you've heard so much about. Several of the others, if you haven't haven't remembered them, I'm glad to mention more. But one of the first questions Cheney was asked was, well, what authorities does the president need to counteract this horrible event that's happened in our country? And so Cheney organized a war council who directed the writing of what we consider now to be the pseudo-legal opinions that have caused such controversy since. One person wrote that, like a high school clique, these members played squash, racquetball together, took secret trips together, while mocking the others who they excluded as being soft and leaking to the press. This is from a book called The Dark Side by Jane Meyer. Some of you may have read it. It's really great. So Tim Flanagan at this time was the deputy White House counsel who was reporting to Alberto Gonzalez. Remember Alberto? Gonzalez was out of town on 9/11. Gelman calls Flanagan crucial to understanding what happened because of his conservative credentials, but more importantly, he had previous experience as being chief of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. And so he was the one that was doing most of the maneuvering and controlling the legal opinions, which laid the foundation for Bush's unprecedented misuse of his executive power. And yet, Flanagan's name is still not quite as commonly known, even though all the books mention it. You is more famously denigrated as being the offerer of the most egregious torture memos, but he was brought onto the team by Flanagan, and he reported to Flanagan. Flanagan admitted he chose you as the go-to guy on foreign affairs. He was the one that Gonzalez and I went to get our advice from. And others say there was a triumvirate, Addington, Flanagan, and Gonzalez. Flanagan had the legal expertise, and they all basically worked under him. I think the thing I better do now is move on to the actual torture. This is how it came to be that any person we deemed to be an enemy was designated to be an enemy combatant. In America, in general, we subscribe to the Geneva Conventions. We subscribe to the belief that people shouldn't be tortured. We subscribe to the fact that even prisoners of war are human beings and deserve a certain amount of respect. But all this was disregarded in this case. And I think at the time, many of us probably thought that's okay because we had felt under such assault. But once that exemption is made, that the normal humanitarian coverage didn't exist in this case and that human rights were up for grabs, then torture was quickly to follow. So the first so-called torture memo was secretly dated in August of 2002, so not even, a year after 9/11. It is now known as the Bybee memo because his signature enacted the decision, but most people feel it was primarily written by John Yoo, but edited by Flanagan. Even Flanagan was shocked at how easily they got permission from Bush for some of the radical behaviors they were writing. "I was astonished," Flanagan said. "David and I were huddled in my office, realizing the bureaucracy was not going to be a bit pleased to see the president act this way on his own without their blessing and without process." And he was also involved in the next memo, which included any military action Bush deemed necessary, including preemptive action, and without asking Congress. So that memo got a little more attention only later. Now let's see. I've just got a tiny bit more on you and Flanagan. Although you has taken much of the criticism in the years since the radical policies were developed, there's no doubt he was a supporting member of the team and was directed by his superior, Flanagan. Gelman quotes who the core team were, and Flanagan had the president and vice president under his ear, and it doesn't get much better than that. That's a quote about the way that things went. And I think maybe I'll just say this off the cuff, which is that I don't doubt in my mind that Flanagan was very sincere, knowing him as little as I did. I think he really felt this weight that he was saving the country. But he also is not willing to consider other points of view, because I've argued politics with him before, and there's definitely a slight bit of hubris in that we know what we're doing and nobody else needs to get involved. Well, it says here that as they wrote memos which allowed them to ignore the Geneva Convention and interrogate and treat prisoners any way they wanted, there were secret consultations with Flanagan and Gonzalez. And this is the time when now they begin to develop what they called enhanced interrogation. It was, of course, not called torture, but I think you all remember that enhanced interrogation then developed into waterboarding and, well, even worse things. Now, speaking of the torture memos, you said Addington and Flanagan assisted in the preparation. He did the writing. And he also was very grateful for their help. And one interesting fact about you, he's not LDS, but he was very close with Hatch. He was named by Hatch earlier in his career to be general counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he's well connected with LDS Republicans. And let's see, I don't want to read every quote I've got on Flanagan because we'll be here all day, although I've got some good ones. They did, the Washington Post did actually editorialize, though, at the time, that Flanagan can piously repeat the administration's insistence that it does not engage in torture. Yet he has refused to say that conduct which might be just short of torture, which is still banned by our treaties and is a stain on our American honor, is either illegal or improper when inflicted on foreigners overseas. Flanagan could not even bring himself to declare particularly barbaric interrogation tactics to be morally off limits. He said he does not believe that the term inhumane treatment is even susceptible to definition. So that was an editorial at the time. Okay, and I don't think I'll say so much about Bybee except that he was more of a follower, most people believe. And I think it's he has been lucky in that he was already named a judge before his name became so associated with the torture memo. And so he's in a fairly safe situation. But some of you might not know that if he goes and speaks at some more liberal law schools and places like that, the students are still known to come walking into the room with garbage bags over their heads, holding their arms out like this, and stand at the back of the room in order to make their point about. So he doesn't have a very easy go at in his career. Now, I'll just say this interesting thing about torture, I think even fewer people know, is that once the torture became established, we began to find out that there's some other Mormons who came into the picture. Maybe some of you know this. James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. These two men are very little known about, and if anybody does know more, I'd like to hear it. They apparently had quite a long career in the CIA, so their offices and everything were, you know, had different names on them, and they didn't just have private practices. Some of you might know that Boyd Peterson wrote a little bit about them in Sunstone a couple of years ago. So, but he didn't. When I talked to him about it, he didn't know any more than I do. But here's the sad thing about him, or the two of them, is that they had both worked in the military, and they had helped set up programs to train our soldiers to endure torture and interrogation. Some of you might be aware there's a program called SERE, S-E-R-E, which stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. So this is a military activity which even Judge Scalia once called it the Jack Bauer from that show. Was that 24? The Jack Bauer techniques. So that's fine. So we're in some ways torturing our own people, but just to teach them. But as 9/11 went forward, they played a central role in trying to turn this back around to torture what we considered the enemy. They have said that they resolutely oppose torture. They've never endorsed it. There was a big article in Vanity Fair in 2007 talking about them. But other than that, they haven't given interviews. They've made themselves very, you know, stay away from that. But they were so controversial, even within the agency, that their names became a litmus test for your attitude on torture. Their critics called them the Mormon Mafia, and the poster boys because they thought they might end up on an FBI torture wall at some point. They did not really have scientific basis for the kinds of interrogation and enhanced interrogation and torture and so on. They developed their ideas not through data or science, because how many people have data and science on this, but they just had basically a theoretical idea of the kinds of things that would work. For instance, they knew that the enemy, Muslims, tend not to like dogs and are scared of dogs, so they brought in the dogs, and as you might remember, they knew, they had this idea from psychology about learned helplessness, that once people feel that they've gone as low as they can go, they're more apt to, you know, give in and do anything. So they came up with a lot of the techniques about bringing in coffins and telling people they were going to bury them alive and then later digging them back up. They took away their comforts and their clothes little by little. They did the music. But little by little, as we all know, these things turned into waterboarding, into long-term, actually being hit and smacked and, you know, being in isolation for long periods of time with the dogs and so on, as well as some of the sexual abuses. Jane Meyer called them good-looking, clean-cut, polite Mormons, and one blog said that they deserved the Dr. Mengele Award for their lying, delusional, faith-based approach to torture. Okay, well, maybe that's enough torture, and I'll move really quickly to what I want to say about it on a more general topic. And then I want to leave time that we have a little bit of discussion. I think that it is pretty discouraging to know that the church did not make a formal stand against torture. And I don't know how many of you are aware of that. Let me make sure I've got the... I was going to read you the statement, but I got to make sure I've got it here. The church decided that it was bad. I mean, they did make a comment here that torture is not... They didn't even say torture. They just simply said that we don't believe in harming people. Sorry, I just don't have it right in front of me. One of my friends gave me a copy of the American Psychological Association Ethics Committee statement, and it took them a long time. She was apologetic because she used to be the head of the APA here in Utah, and this did not come out until June of 2009, so that's quite a while. But at least they realized that these two psychologists who were part of their organization and their same background were doing things that were inappropriate. And they made the statement that torture in any form, in any place, in any time, and for any reason is unethical and wholly inconsistent with membership in the APA. No exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether war, threat of war, internal political instability, public emergencies, or whatever, there's no defense to torture. But our church did not, the only stand it made was that it obviously we don't think that being cruel to people is a good idea, but they wouldn't like to say anything further than that. Now, I don't think it's controversial to point out that some of us might even succumb to torture. Let's be imaginative here and imagine your child just got kidnapped and the kidnapper knows where the child is and, you know, you stand there and choke them until they tell you or whatever. I think any of us understand that impulse and we might do it and we might even find that morally acceptable. But that's a lot different than a state making the profound commitment to torture as a state and trying to legalize it. So I think what this is bringing me to is actually not only torture, but it makes me ponder the consistency of how our church determines what kind of moral issues are so important for them that they make a formal church statement and others that they don't. When the church makes a statement that's formal, generally we don't have to comply, right? I mean, in most cases we're not going to get in trouble in the church if we say no, we don't agree with it. But it's usually so powerful that it sways, we're back to the public square again, it sways public opinion, at least in Utah. And, you know, I'm just going to give a few examples. Some of you might think I'm crazy to go back to the ERA, but why not? Because I was here and I was involved in it. Here's a church news statement from 1980, and I want you to think of the public square when I say this. The first presidency has repeatedly affirmed that ERA is a moral issue with disturbing ramifications for women and for the family as a whole, because it strikes at one of the most basic moral issues, which is that it is clear from the beginning that the Creator designated different roles for men and women, and there's different instructions from the Lord to men and women. Now, I'm not going to go on there, but think of the morality of the ERA. What were women asking for? They were asking for an amendment to be treated equally. Now, I'm not saying that we don't want to revisit it necessarily. The church made it stand. But notice that the language they use to defend their stand is not public square language. It's that the Lord has a different role for men and women. I, of course, think, yeah, we have some different roles because my husband didn't bear the children. I did. But other than that, I mean, our lives are pretty equal. So, okay, but the church felt very strongly about this, and it was defeated, and everybody jumped on board. And yet, torture, you know, okay? So I'm going to come back every few minutes and say, but torture. Some of you might remember this crazy thing. Back in about 1980, my husband and I were delegates to the Democratic National Convention, and the MX missile was a huge thing. If you're old enough, you might recall this. And Jimmy Carter was president then, and he wanted to put these missiles in Utah because it was a good place to... You could hide them into the ground or whatever. And we mostly Democrats took on Jimmy Carter. It might be one reason he lost that election. And Utah environmentalists and pretty soon Scott Matheson, who was governor, began to turn against the MX missile. And I'll give the church credit on this one. The church took a formal position against the MX missile. That's great in this case, right? I don't know why. I mean, I do kind of know why, because they didn't think it would be good for Utah and good for the economy and good for Mormons. It put us in the line of fire. This is just a crazy example. Do you remember when fluoride was going to be a horrible, demonic thing that was in our water to try to turn our children into, I don't know what, zombies? Well, I've got a First Presidency statement on fluoridation, which I totally subscribe to. They say, as with other non-moral issues, which may be under consideration or be brought before the voters by referendum, we reiterate the advice given by leaders of the church from time to time that each citizen should act in accordance with his or her own convictions. We have not in the past, or do we now, seek to bring coercion or compulsion upon the church. Just go vote, basically. Okay, that's pretty cool. But fluoridation, okay, that's not not too important. And yet we see that when it came time for gay people to begin to assert their desires and their needs, whether you believe in gay marriage or not, the church jumped full board, you know, into that. And what is the argument that they give is not, again, public square argument. The arguments are scriptural, is based on the religious beliefs of our leaders. Now, it seems to me that I've read Dallin Oaks very firmly argue that they should be able to use religious language, it should be respected, and they shouldn't have to change it. And of course they don't. But if they want to be heard by anybody outside our church or outside other people, they might want to rethink. Now, I've got several others. I'll just say really quickly, prayer in school. I just want to tell really briefly that I wrote a letter to Dallin Oaks So this is just a firsthand comment, and this was back probably in the early 80s, because he was really, this is when a lot of the first prayer in schools stands were changed by the Supreme Court, that it was wrong to pray in school. And Oaks and the church leadership were arguing very vehemently that it should be allowed. And so I wrote him a letter, because I'll tell you why. My husband and his brothers all grew up in Provo as Muslims, and there weren't a lot of Muslims in Provo. And his family had lived there since the time of World War I, and they all went to the public schools, and they were picked on. And who were they picked on? Not just by Mormons, but by teachers, by principals, by leaders. If it was the dance day, when the dance teacher came around to teach a square dance or whatever, these kids weren't allowed to dance, and so they'd say, "We can't dance," and somebody would cuff them up the side of the head, you know. This early, we forget that teachers were allowed to do these kinds of things just back in the 40s and the 50s. So anyway, Dallin Oaks went to school with one of my brother-in-laws, okay? And he had to have witnessed and did witness that these boys, if they didn't pray like a Mormon, they were hit or sent to the principal's office. And, you know, Muslims in Provo weren't very comfortable getting on the floor and doing their thing. So these boys did not want to fold their arms and bow their heads and pray. And they just somehow waded through it, and they, you know, graduated high school, went on with their lives. They laugh about it now. But I wrote to Dallin Oaks and said, "You had to have seen how the Cater boys were treated. How can you not recognize that prayer in schools is harmful to minority groups? That's why we're not trying to outlaw religion in this court decision. We're trying to protect people who have different beliefs." And he wrote back to me and just said I was totally wrong, and that I misunderstood how important prayer in school was, and that Mormons, if they did have the majority, would be fair with how they handled it, and just get over it, basically. I know when we were first raising our kids in Orem, there was still some prayer in school in Orem. You'll have to tell me nowadays if this is still happening here. And then I'm just going to tell you one thing from yesterday. Well, maybe two things, okay? I'm reading the Tribune and stuff while I'm here on the Deseret News. Gun control has become a faith debate in wake of the shootings at the Aurora, Colorado, right? It says, "Christians fear the political fallout of taking a stand for gun control," argues one Christian writer. This isn't a Mormon, but a Christian writer, who contends that the Bible is murky on abortion and sexuality, but it's crystal clear on the question of whether violence is an acceptable response to violence, and arming ourselves with fists or swords or guns is the way to protect ourselves. So, so now gun control isn't just a matter of public square debate. It's a matter of your faith. Mike Huckabee said the blame for the shooting rampage is the sinful society we live in. We don't have a crime problem or a gun problem or a violence problem. We have a sin problem. And one more. Now I'm back to torture. This is the Tribune on Saturday, this Saturday. "Jailers in Uinta County are shocking the inmates for fun." Did you see this? Two Uinta County jail inmates wanted to join a work crew, but they had to ride the lightning first, which meant grabbing hold of hooks fastened to a car battery, absorbing the electrical shock to the amusement of the jailers, and they both ended up with some need for hospital care and numbness of their extremities and so on. Okay, let me just finish so we can talk just a little bit. Common sense shows that we normally, at least as Americans, don't feel that any other person, any other human being, is so different from us that we are allowed to harm them unless it's a matter of war or self-defense or something like this. We understand also that ethics, I think maybe I should not assume you understand this, but people who are religious are not the only ethical people in the world. Religion is not the only source of being good or choosing morality. And if you study ethics nowadays, you'll find that the common belief now is that we develop our ethical sense from our relationships. It's a cognitive, neurological sort of attachment that we form right from the beginning as we interact. In other words, your ethics don't sit in a vacuum. There's not a rule given by God that says do this or do that. Ethics are derived from our interactions with each other, from what kind of person you are, what kind of person I am. We learn at our parents', you know, knees as they babble to us and talk to us and pat us and we pat back. And so these relationships are what is important. And that's why we don't harm other people. And it doesn't take only a religious person to know that. Atheists are perfectly good people. People who belong to some of the stranger religions, even Scientologists, who I think are the weirdest people on earth, often have at least some respect for one another. So I think that the main thing that the church needs to consider is this idea that they are alone, that they're being repressed themselves from speaking their mind, that they're in some kind of a category where they're the only ones who can identify the moral forces for good in this country. And I think that we need to trust ourselves to know what's good and what's right and to speak up a little bit louder and to make sure the public square does have all voices. And that's my talk. I think we have about what?
Yeah, we've got about 15 minutes for questions. The microphone is on the Fritz, so would you mind just repeating the question for the recorder?
Okay.
And that way we can get them all.
Okay, good. Paul?
Nancy, do you have any thought after reviewing all of this that the Mormon involvement is somehow enhanced by the fact that active Mormons tend to be, shall we say, better networked on a national level than other groups, other faith groups, or other even political interest groups?
So is this problem of, for instance, torture or whatever, enhanced by the number of Mormons?
The involvement of Mormon people in the issue and their being in powerful places. Do you see any networking?
The networking and I would say that the particular danger is that Mormons are seen as only in one party or one position. Mm-hmm. Probably it wouldn't be such a problem if we had more Mormon spread. Maybe some of you would agree with that. We've got Harry Reid, our one and only, you know. But I think that Mormons are so seen as not just Republican but so right-wing that it does sort of categorize us. And I see a little danger in what Romney's doing because he's picking up some of these same people, particularly in foreign policy. So, and Mormons are great networkers because, like in our ward in Virginia, my gosh, they have great jobs. I mean, people with leadership positions in the agencies like CIA and FBI, still that's well known. But in the administration, on the FEC, on the FCC, I mean, all over the place. So once one Mormon gets a good job, they kind of tend to bring somebody they went to law school with or, you know, so on. So I do think that's kind of a problem. Yes?
I was just wondering about our notion that it's okay to lie for the Lord, kind of has spilled over into this, you know, and maybe Flanagan was thinking along the terms of the end justifies the means, which I think lying for the Lord is—that's what that is. And so his idea that he was saving the country then allowed him to okay all the heinous things that ended up being okayed with the Bybee memo and the the different things that, like, maybe put a little postscript in my email: Bush administration, get your nose out of my email. You know? That I took kind of seriously, you know, that they were spying on Americans and all of that type
right.
of thing. But the lying for the Lord.
So I'll just sort of repeat. So the lying for the Lord notion that sort of attached itself to Mormons, could that have had an impact? I don't know whether they would think of it, certainly that formally. I mean, I myself thought that the whole line for the Lord concept was a little bit possible back in Nauvoo times, but do Mormons today really think that? I don't know if it's that or if it's more that they felt justified by circumstances that their secret ideas, and also when you're working together in a group, you reinforce each other's attitude, and pretty soon they just felt justified in going ahead. I'm sure that knowing Flanagan, he would not think he was lying. I bet you he would assert very strongly that he would never, everything he said was not meant that way.
Or that any means justified the end.
I think so, yes. Yeah.
I do believe that the gesture are based on a utilitarian fantasy, which says that, you know, you can, by hurting this one person, achieve the greater good of saving all these other people. But almost probably about 20 years ago, I read a book called The Body in Pain by Elaine Scarry. I don't know if anyone's read it. But she has a chapter on torture in which she went through the records of many people that Amnesty International had helped who had been torture victims. And by analyzing this, she was able to discover, I think, the nature, the purpose and nature of torture. And what she says is that torture is not about getting information. And some pragmatic people have shown that the information derived from torture is unreliable, and basically you'll say anything to escape torture. But what she showed is that the purpose of torture is to terrorize both, it's an instrument of terror, both the person who is being tortured and the larger population, which is somewhat aware of what's going on. So that's one purpose. And the other thing that torture aims to do is to, she calls it, unmake the person, to reduce this person to a nothing, and then to create this person as a compliant servant of the torturers. And, you know, after reading this book, I see no justification for torture. I think torture is always evil, and we should never do it for any reason.
Okay, so Janice is just, I'm saying for the mic that she's commenting on the root results that torturers hope to get from their victims. I will just say that Omar's brother was reactivated. He was a member of the Utah
National Guard.
And in his 50s, he was activated, and he went to, did he go to Bagram prison early on?
As
an interpreter, well, as an interrogator, really, because of his Arabic. And he claims exactly what you said, which is he never met a prisoner that wasn't willing to talk, especially if they actually got a little something from it, like a cup of coffee or a nice big glass of cold water. He said that he couldn't imagine why the torturing was taken to the extremes it was, because, I mean, there might be this one person in a million, but it wasn't even really
just
necessary.
Just establishing a relationship between the interrogator and the person being interrogated.
Right.
A relationship of respect, in my opinion,
right,
leads to too much correct information.
That's what he said.
No.
Mm-hmm. Okay, back here.
I don't remember the name of the act, but it seems like in 2006 or so, the Congress debated enhanced interrogation techniques and basically kind of ended up saying that the government could continue doing what it was doing. And I don't know if you recall that, but I remember being very disappointed. It seemed that the LDS senators, I think there were at least five, Gordon Smith, the Utah ones, an Idaho one, and Harry Reid, and just split on party lines. And I don't know if that's something you've looked at, or if there were any statements about by those LDS senators about their positions on that.
You know, I do kind of remember that, but I don't remember any particular statement, and I don't think I have any research on it right now. But I'm pretty sure that nobody was going to want to go too far to outlaw torture at that point, because then what do we do with these actual leaders? Are we going to put Cheney in jail for what he did, you know? So, but yeah, that might be interesting to go back and see. And as I tried to point out, there are some writers who have made a point that these are Mormons in their books, but everybody hasn't pointed that out. A lot of people haven't noticed the significance of that. It might be significant to us, but not to every writer. So, Yeah.
Where is Flanagan and Mitchell now?
Flanagan is working for a law firm, and a couple of his children are still in the area. And the last I heard, he had a great job for, I forgot which big law firm, and he lives sometimes on the beach in North Carolina and commutes by helicopter or airplane or something. And I don't want to give the impression he's just living big, because he's the guy that had, how many children, Omar?
14
children. And they've never had tons of money, even though he's worked for big law firms. He's gone in and out of government, so I wouldn't call him rich, but I think at this point he's basically laying low. He's not. He did work for someone else controversial, Tyco, for a while. When they were having a big lawsuit, the whole company was under pressure because of some illegal practices. So,
did Flanagan grow up Mormon? Flanagan is not exactly a Utah Mormon name.
No, he didn't. But he's a convert, I think, from Catholics. His wife is a Mormon long term. Yeah.
Is a judge, isn't he now?
California. I thought that was a law professor.
Bybee's a federal judge. Bybee's on the Ninth
Now,
Circuit.
Would you remind us, was anyone ever prosecuted?
Mm-hmm. No. There were all sorts of threats of criminal prosecution.
Yeah.
I think with Bybee, they decided that they couldn't because being a judge isolates you. I don't quite know what the law is there, but he had some protection by the status of where he was that they
could only impeach him, I think.
I think that's right. I think he could be impeached.
But there are still warrants from the International Criminal Court that prevent Cheney, Bush, Rumsfeld, and others from traveling internationally. As a matter of fact, Bush just altered travel within the last year. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't go to Canada for a warrant. Mm-hmm.
So there is still some possible legal problems that they could have, just depending on where they present themselves and where they go. Yes, way in the back.
I'm wondering, in the statement that the church did not make about a statement against torture and on other issues that the church hasn't made any comments about, in your opinion, how much does the membership of the church play into those decisions? In other words, does the church say, we are not going to issue a statement about torture because we have members who will not tolerate that very well, and we might have a mass exodus, and so we just won't touch it? Or does that, do you think, play into the church's decisions to make statements one way or the other on anything ever? Does membership ever become a factor?
Okay, so the question is whether the church membership makes any difference in what kinds of statements the church makes. I'm not aware of the church ever polling the members. I don't know really how they pick up their information. I mean, I still remember, I think my husband and I were a young married couple when the birth control statement came out. And we walked out of sacrament meeting where it had been read, and I said, wow, that was a pretty good statement. It basically still allows us to make our own choices. And the person I said that to said, no, that said no birth control. You know, and I mean, do we hear what we want? I don't know. But on the other hand, I'm very active in fertility clinic ethics, and I consult at an actual fertility clinic and hear their cases and so on. And the church has been pretty moderate on that. They haven't made very strong statements about whether it's okay to use egg donors or, you know, the kinds of things that the Catholics are a little bit concerned about. So I don't quite know why in some cases they go against something and other times they really don't.
Last question. On immigration, the church went specifically against the popular opinion here in Utah and reversed popular opinion.
Oh, that's a good point. The immigration stuff that's going on right now. Okay, well, so I'd love to hear from all of you if you have any other good examples. So if I ever do this talk again, I'll have even more information. And I appreciate your coming, and I hope that we can talk about all these things more in the next couple of days. And thanks for having me.